the war in Yemen, now entering its sixth year, continues to claim lives, especially those of children suffering acute malnutrition at unprecedented rates. Has the international reaction been enough, as funding has fallen far short of what is needed to offset the effects of the conflict? And also, what about the economic collapse that has ensued? In this edition of The Debate, we will look at why the world looks on as Saudi Arabia continues this war with the U.S. support. Okay, let's start with our correspondent first to find out the latest about the situation in Yemen. We have Abdul Al-Awashedi, who joins us from the capital, Sana'a. This report by the UN, can you please tell us more about the depth of how the Yemeni children are suffering, and then expand more as to how, under the COVID-19, Yemen in general is coping with the pandemic?
As you know, a report, or UN report, says that acute malnutrition is spreading among children, and severe acute malnutrition is has increased this year and about 15%. So we have a lot of problems in Yemen because of the war, because of the Saudi coalition and their siege upon Yemenis. Yemen is approaching a dire food security crisis. 80% of the people in Yemen are suffering, and they're depending on any form of help from organizations, from UN organizations. So UN knows what is happening in Yemen. They know how the humanitarian situation is getting worse and worse each day. They didn't do anything to for Yemenis. Instead, they have removed the name of Saudi Arabia from the blacklist of children killers.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We appreciate that. That's our correspondent, Abdul Latif Al-Awashedi there, talking to us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Let me introduce our guest. We have Alaija Magnier, who's a journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels. We also have Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia, who joins us from Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome you both. And Alaija, if I may first start with you, this UN report is quite alarming. It should somewhat have been anticipated, but the depth of it maybe is not something that's very well known. And I'll start out with the first part of this report that we have picked out as a highlight, where Yemeni children suffering record rates of acute malnutrition, and this is the part that needs to be highlighted, putting an entire generation at risk. Do you find this surprising and shocking at the same time, given the fact that you're looking at a war that is now into the sixth year?
Well, Yemen was declared the world's largest humanitarian disaster by the United Nations. And it is, the UN estimate 80% of the population, that is around 24 million people, requires some form of humanitarian protection assistance, including 14.3 million who are in acute need. So we're talking about two-thirds of all districts in Yemen, of the country, are already in pre-famine. We're talking also about an impossible situation described by all humanitarian UN organizations that are on the ground, and they describe it as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, yet we don't have the resources that need to save the people who are suffering and who are continuous dying. And then also there is the COVID pandemic that is spreading. There are 3,500 hospitals and medical facilities in the country, but only half of these facilities are functioning. That means the country population of around 24 million will have no access to adequate health care. Now, the point is, and here is quite an hypocrisy, is I've been in Bosnia during the war, and we see the international community very happy to invest billions of dollars and euros supporting humanitarian support, help to the population, but not to stop the war. So we saw in 2019, the international community spent $2.6 billion in aid operation. In 2020, they spent only $558 million. And in 5 years of conflict, this is going to cost the international community $29 billion. Now, if we add these 29 billions to almost 100 billion spent by the Saudis, and rather than waging war on Yemen, we invested in constructing the country, we will have the richest and the most beautiful country in the world. And that is the hypocrisy, and this is where it is quite shocking to continue accepting war crimes happening every single day by the Saudis, and yet this is our best Western ally.
Oh, well, this takes a rather new turn to the conversation. So let me ask you, if I may, Michael Springman. Our guest highlights a very important point when it comes to the finances. You know, when you take a look at the humanitarian help that has come through, even though it hasn't helped as much as it should, and even though it hasn't been enough, and we're going to talk about that shortly. In terms of the ratio, you're looking at Saudi Arabia to spend almost five times as much on the war itself. And this could have, in the meantime, made Yemen one of the most, not one, but a prosperous nation within its own ranks. So why is Saudi Arabia spending the kind of money that it is on this war, do you think?
Well, it's gotten itself into a hole that it can't get out of. It has invested so much time, money, and effort into trying to destroy Yemen that it simply doesn't want to back out of it. It wants to continue on. It wants to save face. It wants to shore up the apparent Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his position there, and to show that he's really doing something for Saudi Arabia, when in fact he's not. And I think that behind a lot of this, that's not brought out into the open, is Israel, the apartheid entity. They have uncovered caches of Israeli weapons and ammunition. They found documents saying that the American government wants to work with Israel to control Purim Island near the Bab al-Mandeb to ensure the safety and security of Israel. Israel has in the past repeatedly intervened in Yemen on one side or another. Israel has warships patrolling the waters around Yemen. And Israel is conducts a very good relations or has great friendship with the Southern Transitional Council, which is backed by the United Arab Emirates terrorist group. So they are there, and nobody dares gainsay the Israelis because they control just about everything that happens internationally these days. They even approved the sale of American weapons to the United Arab Emirates. Not the American Congress, mind you, but Israel.
So what do you think of that, Elijah Magnier, the Israeli role in the war in Yemen? I mean, is there something there that, as our guest indicated, to secure the safety of Israel, which plays a part in this war?
Well, I think Israel is today the ally of Saudi Arabia, the ally of the Emirates, and there is a normalization of the situation between the two countries, and the Saudis are still hesitant to declare it. Therefore, this relationship and the involvement of the Saudis and the Emiratis in the war in Yemen, when the Emiratis themselves say that we are on very high level of cooperation with the Israelis on intelligence and military levels, they are indeed cooperating in Yemen, and they are present with the Israelis in Yemen. And it is in the interest of Israel to control Bab al-Mandeb and to control all the maritime way, particularly trying to turn the enemy today in the Middle East from being Israel to being Iran. And they think by countering Iran and countering Yemen, that will help them to submit Iran in one way or another. That's why the Israelis are indeed present in multiple stages. They are present in Syria, where the Americans are occupying the northeast and using the American occupation forces facilities to bomb Iraq, as the U.S. ambassador said. They are trying to create havoc in Lebanon on the borders and transportation. So they want to be present in Yemen as they want to be present along with the Saudis and along with the Emiratis. That definitely.
We need to take a look at the arms sales, Michael Springman, if we can. Now, what is very ironic about this is that you are looking at, for example, this one headline reading, a deadly concoction of arms sales conflict at COVID-19, in which you have a catastrophe humanitarian-wise that's fueled by Western arms shipments. And according to this one report, is getting much worse. The irony, and I'd like to get your reaction on this, is that most of these arms come first from the U.S., followed by the U.K., France, Spain, Italy, Germany, and Canada. And yet you have some of these countries that are veto-wielding members of the UN who publicly say, hey, let's go for a ceasefire. Please stop this war. But then they're selling arms. So isn't that a double standard somewhat in play?
Certainly it is. These people are morons, and they are some of the countries listed that you just mentioned are some of the most hypocritical countries going. Germany always bleats about how it wants peace, and yet it supports the American wars of aggression in the Middle East. Canada keeps going on and on about how they are neutral, they are a small country, they want to be a force for peace, yet their government is firmly in the grip of the apartheid entity and is oppressing the Palestinians in Canada and doing its best to oppress the Palestinians in Palestine. So I think that hypocritical is probably a mild word to use for it. These are the people that are really responsible for the deaths of the children and the generation that's supposedly trying to grow up in the midst of starvation and disease and so forth. Yet they don't recognize reality and refuse to recognize reality. They prefer to hide behind their mask of, oh, yes, we're trying to help. We're talking about trying to help, and we're saying all kinds of good and wonderful things. But in actual fact, we're not going to take one step towards putting an end to this mess in Yemen because it would hurt our businessmen and hurt our businesses and hurt our politicians.
I can't help but to ask you about how once Elijah Magnier, the U.S. president, referred to Saudi Arabia as milking the cow when it comes to arms sales. How much of this is what this conflict is all about, especially when you have not only the U.S., but other countries that are selling Saudi Arabia arms, along with the UAE and whatever is left of the coalition?
Well, if we look at arms sales, it should be bound to international law. So any country accused of war crime should not be provided with weapons from the Western countries. And if you look at the Saudi-led coalition and its allies, they are documented responsible for the highest civilian fatalities from direct targeting. Human Rights Watch documented at least 90 unlawful coalition airstrikes on homes, markets, hospitals, schools, and mosques and other civilian buses. We're talking about wedding, we're talking about the gathering of children. But on the other hand, we see the Americans are saying very clearly, we don't want to lose the Saudi money and we want to provide them with the weapons they need. So they continue to killing people in Yemen. We know that they are killing honest, innocent people in Yemen, but yet we don't want to give up on the money they are providing. We look at the UK. UK, they say we are examining, and they try to use all these very beautiful English word from the dictionary to soften the way to put Saudis away from being accused of war crime and just only to provide them with the weapons they need by looking at if there are historical breaches or if there are possible violations or patterns. What do they want more than UN documenting all these violations? And all the NGOs on the ground are saying, these are the pictures, these are the documents, and the Saudi-led coalition is really bombing civilians, and you should stop arming them. And instead of financing all these, investing all these billions to wage the war and continue the war, stop providing Saudis with weapons, and sit around the table like they've done in Stockholm 2018, and then in Riyadh 2019, we had this good news of releasing 1,018 prisoners, but then everything has stopped, and we back as business as usual.
Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Michael Springman, has been named as one of the most dangerous threats to U.S. national security. This goes back years ago. But yet you have, in the year 2019, a report that came out that AP did a special investigation on, saying that Saudi Arabia and the UAE are giving U.S. arms to al-Qaeda-linked groups, and they are fighting with al-Qaeda on the ground in order to beat the Ansar al-Fighters. So we can see how this can actually backfire, but yet the thirst for beating the Ansarullah fighters, which they have been unsuccessful of doing, is coming at any cost, it appears. Does the U.S. realize what game it's getting itself into, which at this point we don't know if it's still continuing or not?
Well, given the fact that the U.S. has been working with terrorist organizations ever since the beginning of the war against the Soviet Union with the Mujahideen, I think the U.S. does indeed know what's going on, and it does indeed know that it is training and supporting and giving weapons to these people and what they're doing with them. I think it's a pretend war in many instances, as I mentioned that to some extent in my book, Thesis for Al-Qaeda. But I think also that the U.S. doesn't really care. It likes to manufacture dangers and conflicts and threats to American existence, even if it comes from half a world away and has nothing at all to do with the United States or the American people. However, its fear is always good. It used to be the Soviet Union that was the course of the source of the fear. Then it was communism in general. Then it was terrorists, and then it was terrorists in particular, and terrorists in specific areas, and so on and so forth. But you can't justify this huge American military arms budget for its war machine. You can't justify the fortunes that are fueling the operation of the Central Intelligence Agency and the other American intelligence services. You can't justify the clampdown on personal liberties in the United States unless you have enemies somewhere. And like the Roman Empire, if there aren't enemies, then the United States will manufacture them either by attacking some country and creating a counterattack, or it will imagine that something is happening and claim that this is really an attack. So it's something that's been running through American politics since the end of the war, 75 years ago.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That was Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia. Thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels, and Abdul Latif Al-Wasadi, who was our correspondent who spoke to us at the top of the hour. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitali, the entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. So welcome to this program, Back to Reality. This program is broadcast on Arba'in, the 40th day of martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. In this program, our brothers and sisters speak about the cultural differences and gatherings for Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him. Sister Razia, Sister Zainab, Brother Ibrahim, Brother Dara.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. The point that I wanted to mention that we have in the Iranian culture is that one specific day in the early days of Muharram, I heard that it's the first Friday in the month of Muharram, there is this custom, it's been going on for the last few years, that moms who have little infants from 2-3 months old to 1 or 2 years old, they dress their babies with clothes of of an Arab, like a very white, beautiful robe, and with a green headscarf, wanting to show and to make tangible what happened to the little infant of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Ali Asghar, on the day of Ashura. As I remember one ceremony, in one session, one morning session, the lecturer was saying that Ali Asghar had gone through so much thirst and so much difficulty that he was opening and closing his mouth like a fish that has been caught from water and is like passing the last few moments of his life. In other words, whether Imam Hussein had taken his beloved 6-month-old infant to ask for water from the enemy or not, the infant would have died anyways because of thirst. When what happened was that Imam Hussein alayhi salam takes the 6-month-old infant and asks for a drink of water. Just imagine the heat in the land of Karbala, the amount of thirst that all the members of his family had been experiencing in that scorching heat in that desert. And specifically, it was so hard to bear seeing an infant whose mother's milk was no longer there because of the thirst that also she has experienced. And they could do nothing for this little baby. So Imam takes him to the enemy, asking for just a drop of water. Especially, I'm talking about in that sense that he was passing his last moments of life, and the answer, the response of the enemy was to throw an arrow with 3 heads to the tender throat of Ali Asghar alayhi salam. So that is why every year, even I remember with my own daughter, when she was really small, she was less than 1 year old, I took her to the session that all these moms gather, and witnessing that that beautiful, tragic scene would make the event of Ashura more tangible for you. Of course, again, this is considered among the black pages of history, and with it comes the white page. And to that, the white pages, what was the message behind the event of Ashura? Why was he forced to take part in this event? And it's a chance for all of us to reconsider ourselves, reconsider our values, our lifestyle, and to, you know, to constantly be re-evaluating and evaluating ourselves and our paths in life. May we train ourselves, may we educate ourselves and our families in a way that we would be sincere, honest soldiers in the camp of the last Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala hasten his reappearance. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh my child, oh my child.
I am Brother Yasser Ibrahim. I am from South Africa. And this is my experiences of the morning ceremonies for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I, alhamdulillah, have had the opportunity to see ceremonies in South Africa. I've had the opportunity to see them in England, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, in Iraq, in Australia. Something that I remember quite frankly, first of all, for me as somebody who's coming from a background that did not really truly understand that this kind of event, coming from a background that was obviously not as a follower of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, going to England the first time, experiencing it, seeing that, okay, why are people coming here? Why are they crying? What is this all about? That actually led me to my own personal journey towards finding the truth. Why was this not told to us? Why were we not spoken about? For I remember quite, you know, clearly and frankly that when we were in school, that we were told that the Islamic governance after Imam Hassan alayhi salam, which was for 6 months, kind of stopped, and there was no khilafah after that. So we were not told about all of this. One of the first things that struck me is that, what is this? Then obviously we have the cultural things that occurred in England. The United Kingdom, we see that people are from migrant background, India, Pakistan, and they come with their own styles. And what was fascinating is that when I was in England, it began to change. That obviously you have second, third generation Shia and Muslims who were born in that country. he wanted things to be spoken about in English, the majalis to be in English, the masaib or the actual story to be told in English. And this is what happened during that particular time until we are today, where majority of the actual centers actually mention it in English. South Africa is no different, South Africa, because the lack of migrants, you have a growth from within. So it is right now a kind of culture that is being built. One thing that I found really fascinating in South Africa was that I have a friend, or somebody who I know, he was Christian. Majority of the Shia in South Africa were actually Christians who became Shia afterwards. He was a Christian and he used to be in the choir, the church choir. And he would recite the poetry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the local language, and it was very beautiful because he had that church tone to it, you know, that singing tone to it. It was very beautiful. And one thing in South Africa that is beginning to occur now is that the local languages are starting also to get some attention. It's not only English they're trying to target and trying to give other people the message of Imam Hussein al-Islam in their own local languages, which is something of extreme importance. Another thing that should be mentioned as a final point is that we should not, you know, judge every single country on how they mourn Imam Hussein, as long as you're doing it in the proper way within the laws of the divine law of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Do not say that mine is better than yours or this one is better than theirs.
My name is Dara from the United States, and what I have to say about the Muharram in Karbala, it's in America, it's very interesting because you have the opportunity to see different cultures, different people from different backgrounds, converts, you Arabs, Pakistani Indians, or Desis, Iranians, Iraqis. So it's very interesting, and most of the communities over there and the centers are different people from different backgrounds. They gathered there, and in time of Muharram is such a way that there are so many programs going on that you don't want to lose the opportunity. You want to be in every center, and a lot of programs are going, and a lot of the ulamas or the leaders, Islamic leaders, they're traveling to different centers. Also, there's a procession going, and people go to the procession, New York, Los Angeles, and the big city, to do the matams in Night of Muharram to show their respect to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And beside all these things, and one movement started in Europe and America, is the name Who is Hussein? And this movement is a very interesting movement that technically it brought the revolution of Imam Hussein to the social justice. So you start talking about who is Hussein in such a way that giving food and water to the people, and they create the opportunity to start a dialogue about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And this was one of the things that people were doing in that time. As people love the Latmiyas, and a lot of people, they take the same tone of the matam in, for example, in Iranian Arabic, and they try to recite it with English. There's a lot of programs that during the Muharram happens, and it's just the main important thing, I think, is the unity. This is one of the things, because people from all over different backgrounds, they gather together in one place for the same thing, for the love of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And you see how people sacrifice and during that time their love and everything toward each other. And you, this is the most you see, in the same time you see the chaotic events is going on, and you just remembering Imam Hussein, people are in tears, but in the same time you see harmony, you see peace, you see like you feel strength, you power, because you are with your brothers and sisters. And that's, it's something that I think, so that's a minimum thing we really can talk about.
So there was this year that we were commemorating Imam Hussein alayhi salam in one of the Southeast Asian countries, and
they had this whole huge sound system, their amplifiers and their microphones and their speakers. And we were saying Hussein, Hussein. And though there were guards around, no one really told us to keep it down, simmer down, don't yell too much, don't make too much noise. But this moment I remember distinctly is from the noon of Ashura. After 10 nights of saying Hussein, Hussein into the microphone and amplifying it into the neighborhood to an extent, it was Salat al-Dhuhr. It was the noon prayers. And after the Latmiyat, the person, while the crowd was saying Hussein, Hussein and beating their chest, he decided to give out the call of the adhan. He said, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. He said, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. And the moment he wanted to say, Ashhadu anna Aliyan Waliullah.
Ashhadu anna
That made my heart die instantaneously at that very moment. But then when years passed, I looked back and I thought to myself that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is what's going to save us and this nation. We still live in a time that we cannot yell Imam Ali's name off the rooftops, but Hussein ibn Ali, the son of Ali, is the power, the source, the glue that's going to bring our hearts closer, because verily, إِنَّ فِي قَتْلِ الْحُسَيْنِ حَرَارَةٌ لَنْ تَبْرَدَ أَبَدًا. Verily, in the death of Hussein lies a fire that will never cool down.
يَا اللَّهُ يَا رَبَّ الْعَالَمِينَ يَا رَحْمَنُ يَا رَحِيمُ يَا رَبِّي Let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahmanu, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
Pakistan and Iran have moved forward to expand their bilateral cooperation in major fields. During Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif's visit to Islamabad, both neighbors decided to expand their ties in the field of commerce, investment, regional connectivity, security, and people-to-people exchanges. The border management and geostrategic issues in the region linked with the security of both countries were at the center of the bilateral discussions. Iran has a long-standing concern over the back-and-forth movement of militants and smugglers at its shared porous border with Pakistan, something which also came under bilateral discussions.
We had a very good discussion on border cooperation, including border markets, as well as opening a new border crossing in Rimdan Gabit between Iran and Pakistan, which will happen hopefully within a week or two.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the political uncertainty revolving around Afghan peace deal after the disputed presidential elections in the United States amid allegations of electoral fraud, it remains unclear on whether or not Joe Biden will withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan by May next year under a peace deal between the current U.S. administration and Afghan Taliban in early this year. The huge financial and military losses in the 19-year-long war compelled the White House to have a deal with the Taliban largely on the terms and condition of the militants, something which many in the U.S. believe is a surrender deal.
On Afghanistan, we have almost similar views. Iran wants peace and stability in Afghanistan, so do we. We have decided to have more frequent discussions on Afghan situation.
A few weeks back, Donald Trump said that the U.S. forces are going to withdraw, even they will have the Christmas in America. They are that much in rush. But, you know, after the, Democratic government, when they come into power in January, so I think they have a fear of change in the policies. This is the most important subject which foreign minister of Iran and the Pakistani authorities discuss.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the hideouts of the Daesh militants in Afghanistan, which they fear may be harder to dismantle if the peace deal derails. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Clerics from major monotheistic religions gathered here in Tehran for an important goal: to promote peace based on religious commonalities. Delegates representing Islam, Christianity, and Judaism unanimously agreed that the root cause of intolerance and extremism lies in the lack of dialogue among religious leaders.
The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. The Holy Quran has a special chapter about Saint Mary and Moses. So religions don't have any issues with each other. Therefore, it is upon us scholars to raise awareness and enlighten the minds of our people to respect other religions.
This session comes against the backdrop of repeated acts of blasphemy in France against the sectaries of Muslims. Scholars slammed the French government for lending its support to the growing anti-Islamic rhetoric in the country. This as President Emmanuel Macron argues that he seeks to promote freedom of speech. These people say freedom of expression is praiseworthy, as long as it does not contradict the right to freedom of religion.
What the French president says is merely based on his deeply entrenched racist mentality. His comments on Islam have nothing to do with free speech. His actions are aimed at spreading Islamophobia to further marginalize Muslims. Now you tell me, is this freedom of speech or is it suppression of Muslims' right to a free religion?
Iran is home to different religious minorities, from Christians and Jews to Zoroastrians. All are represented in the parliament. Scholars believe peaceful coexistence among religions hinges on a collective effort by religious leaders to sit and talk based on the commonalities.
Representatives of different religions here say what the French president describes as freedom of speech is in fact freedom of hate speech, not only against the sanctities of Muslims, but against all monotheistic religions, since they believe in the same God and honor each other's prophets. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's oil minister says the latest wave of sanctions imposed by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump, which targets the Islamic Republic's oil sector, has no practical effect and stems from Washington's grudge against Tehran. The U.S. administration imposed a fresh round of sanctions on a number of Iranian individuals and entities affiliated with the Islamic Republic's oil sector, including Minister of Petroleum Bijan Zangane. In its statement, the U.S. Treasury Department said the sanctions targeted eight officials and entities, as well as the National Iranian Oil Company, NIOC, and the National Iranian Tanker Company, NITC. The companies of Madanipur, Mobin Holding Limited, and Oman Fuel Trading LTD were also blacklisted.
If they have any proof that I'm working with IRGC, they need to show me. If they have any proof that I'm working with the PDVSA of Venezuela, they need to show me. If they are respecting their rule and their court, they need to respect and give back the property.
Incoming reports show that Trump plans to impose a flood of new sanctions against Iran, but the Iranian oil minister Zangane says they have sanctioned whatever exists, and that the only thing left for Washington to sanction is probably the services sector.
We have plenty of oil resources, and we want to work with all the people of the world. We are friends with all the people in the region, and they are helping us, and they are working with us. And if America wants to sanction, it doesn't change anything at all.
Tehran believes the era of unilateralism is over in the world, and that Iran's oil industry will not be hamstrung. Robert O'Brien, U.S. President Donald Trump's national security advisor, has recently said that the U.S. has imposed so many sanctions on Iran that, quote, there is very little left for us to do, unquote. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister says Washington needs to kick the habit of sanctions because it gets nowhere. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
After the deal was announced, people flooded the streets of Azerbaijan's capital to celebrate the end of the conflict and the gains made. Via the deal, Baku will hold on to areas of Nagorno-Karabakh that it took during the conflict, including the enclave's second city of Shusha, and between now and December 1st, ethnic Armenian forces must give up control of a slew of other territories.
I bow down in front of the families and mothers of the martyrs. We rejoice today at the cost of their children's blood. I bow down to them. That's all I can say.
However, over in Armenia, there is no jubilation. Protesters have stormed the parliament, branding the prime minister a traitor and calling for him to resign. Although the leadership of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave says 1,200 of its defense forces have been killed, and the main city of Stepanakert would have been lost within days if the fighting had continued, some say victory was possible. Armenia's prime minister says the deal was unbelievably painful but unavoidable.
Under the circumstances, making a different decision wasn't possible. I plan to give more details why it wasn't and tell everyone the reason behind last month's events. I can't do it right now for one simple reason, because we are in the process of stopping military action right now, and if I say something, I might endanger people.
Keeping a close eye on the conflict throughout, Iran, which shares borders with the disputed region, called for a peaceful settlement of the conflict that respected international law and the territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the arrangement will pave the way for a lasting political settlement. For now, the battle is over, and thousands of people will now be left to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The United States has not been so divided in recent memory as there are two people claiming to be president. The mainstream media rushed to accept Joe Biden's declaration of victory, even though he has an average lead of only 32,000 votes in three states in a vote which is not even finished counting yet. Donald Trump has also claimed victory prematurely. It appears half the country believes Biden is the president-elect, while the other half believes Trump is the president-elect. No one knows what will happen next, and many fear tensions could elevate into violence.
Joe Biden has won. Trump may contest it, but the evidence is there. There is no illegal things regarding vote. The system has worked, and it will continue. One man will not ruin this system for us. Joe Biden is now our president.
And one thing I want to add, it's not Republican versus Democrat. It's we are Americans.
American, special of our country.
Period.
But mail-in ballots were used in unprecedentedly massive numbers, and the vote's legality has been openly disputed for many months. It seems certain the courts will ultimately decide the legality of the vote, and maybe even who won, as in the year 2000, which caused massive political alienation, cultural division, and mistrust. The lack of trust is also because the U.S. election process is considered the worst of any of the core Western democracies. That's according to the Harvard-based Electoral Integrity Project, whose 2019 index ranked U.S. elections just 57th in the world. pro-Biden corporate media is seemingly acting as if there is no dispute at all, while skeptical pro-Trump outlets insist this unique election must be vetted by the courts and that Trump must not concede before that process is finished.
I think he'll just give it up eventually. People will stop giving him airtime, stop giving him attention, and he'll just give up. He'll figure out another way to be in the news and all over the place.
Both sides appear to be bewildered by the stance of the other side, and both sides are certain of their own righteousness. With two presidents, many say the U.S. election could not have turned out worse, and the worst seems yet to come. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has congratulated U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. In a statement, Abbas said he looks forward to working with the president-elect and his administration. Palestinian officials have expressed their satisfaction with the departure of outgoing President Donald Trump and said for them nothing was worse than Trump's era.
We welcome the results of the American elections. Like many world states, we agreed that Trump's era was a nightmare. As President Abbas said, we are looking forward to achieve freedom, independence, justice, and dignity for our people. All previous U.S. administrations had specific commitments towards Israel, but this time we hope we can cooperate with the new administration.
Several Palestinian political groups have also expressed their satisfaction with, in the first place, the departure of President Donald Trump, the man who took several anti-Palestinian measures, including recognition of Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital in late 2017, moving the U.S. embassy there, and declaring the so-called deal of the century. This had led the Palestinian Authority to halt its political dealings with Trump's administration.
We don't expect to witness a great difference between U.S. administrations and the Israeli regime. But Trump tarnished U.S. image and harmed its interests in the region. I hope Biden can make the U.S. committed to international law. Biden and Trump differ in everything, in performance and reasoning.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was among Trump's close allies around the world, waited 12 hours to congratulate Biden. But at the same time, he thanked Trump for taking U.S.-Israel ties to an unprecedented level. For Palestinians, a change of administration in the U.S. is not a promise of change in Washington's policy toward them. However, Palestinians do hope for a gain in Donald Trump's departure, as his term in office is considered the worst even among most hostile U.S. presidents. Mona Khandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Coronavirus cases among the general population are rapidly increasing in the Gaza Strip as over 200 infections are being discovered daily. The first community spread of the deadly virus was detected in late August, and over 8,000 cases have been discovered so far. Health officials have sounded the alarm over the rising figures in the densely populated enclave.
The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is high, and we are extremely worried due to the rising number. We are doing our best to deal with the situation. We are working round the clock to detect infections.
The coronavirus has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. COVID-19 has threatened the socioeconomic welfare of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here don't have access to preventive equipment because they are crash-strapped. They can hardly provide food for their families.
People have been suffering from the Israeli blockade, and now the situation has only gotten worse because of the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. Gaza's health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies.
14 years of the inhumane Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip have taken their toll on the humanitarian, health, and economic situation. The Israeli blockade has left the health system in Gaza in ruin, making it unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the Gaza Strip, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
As infections continue to rise, rights groups are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the deadly coronavirus. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The head of the UK Armed Forces has warned if current smaller conflicts escalate out of control, drawing in more countries and weapons, World War III might break out. In a Remembrance Day interview with Sky News, General Sir Nick Carter said the world is currently, quote, a very uncertain and anxious place.
We have to remember history might not repeat itself, but it has a rhythm. And if you look back at the last century, before both world wars, I think it was unarguable that there was escalation that led to the miscalculation, which ultimately led to war at a scale we would hopefully never see again.
General Carter says that the British Army will comprise 90,000 human soldiers and 30,000 robots by the 2030s. And aside from modernizing and amplifying its own military, the UK is still the world's second largest arms exporter. Military arms deals worth an estimated £39 billion were approved between 2008 and 2017, a third of which went to countries with abysmal human rights records.
But we have not seen any evidence of that. If we stop selling them the bombs, if we stop selling them the planes, that will have an impact on Saudi and on what Saudi can do in Yemen, because we are one of the main exporters of arms to Saudi Arabia, and frankly, we can't make bombs fast enough for them.
The UK currently has £11 billion worth of orders. So how does stockpiling and exporting arms factor into the UK's World War III game plan?
The UK government has spent hundreds of billions of pounds, large amounts of which have yet to be properly even accounted for, in response to the coronavirus crisis. And General Carter knows full well, I suspect, as do many others in government, that at some point a reckoning for this is going to come, and this money is going to have to be found somewhere, either through tax rises or more likely through departmental budget cuts. And that time is fast approaching, when indeed the British government, as indeed other governments, are going to have to start doing the mathematical reckoning for their spending. And so I think possibly what's the motive here for General Carter as head of the UK Armed Forces to remind yet again for the message that is constantly being put out by the think tanks and the media that support strong armed forces, that is that the world is a dangerous place.
The world is still reeling from the results of the presidential elections in the US, undisputedly the world's military heavyweight. And although Donald Trump's four-year term was the first without a new war since Eisenhower, his administration has allowed military voices to shout down those of experienced civil servants in the development of foreign policy. Funding cuts to non-defense federal agencies and many career civil servants resigning means policy planning is being entrusted invariably to those in uniform. Bianca Rahimi, London.
On Friday, taxi drivers went on a one-day strike nationwide, calling the government's attention to the economic plight they're facing following the pandemic crisis and the connected restrictions. Unions also called two protests held in front of the Economy and Transport Ministries, attended by thousands of taxi drivers from across the country. Drivers are demanding more support from the government as, quote, they don't have the money to pay the monthly costs of the vehicles, nor to provide for their families.
Gli aiuti ricevuti sono assolutamente insufficienti.
The subsidies we have received from the government so far are totally inadequate. €275 each month is not sufficient. How are we supposed to put food on the table for our families? Consider we have suffered losses in the range of 80 to 90%.
Intorno ai €3,600.
Io ho ricevuto.
My income has dropped by 80%, but all expenses have remained unvaried. Insurance fees, fuel and car disinfection costs have not been reduced. Furthermore, the government is doing nothing to stop illegal cabs from going around.
È molto alta.
A new three-tier restriction system came into force on Friday. As a result, four Italian regions, namely Calabria, Lombardy, Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, have been placed in soft lockdowns. The government has also imposed a nationwide curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m., requiring all museums and galleries to shut down and all shopping centers to close on weekends.
Protests against the new anti-COVID restrictions imposed by the government have been staged in a number of cities across Italy. Some demonstrations turned violent as protesters vented their frustration and anger over how the pandemic crisis has been handled.
The virus is a moving train. Today it is necessary to slow it down, otherwise the train will knock us down. We are hopeful that these measures will be limited to several weeks.
The new restrictions imposed by the Italian government apply for about 4 weeks until December 3. Max Civili, Rome.
In the limelight.
Israeli settler attacks on Palestinian olive trees take place throughout the year, but they consistently increase in number and intensity during the annual olive season in Palestine, usually from mid-September to mid-November. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by the staff of Middle East Eye website, which is published under the heading Bitter Tears for Palestinian Olive Trees. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Walking between what remains of the 300 olive trees waiting to be harvested, 69-year-old Khaled Mashallah breaks down in tears. In one day, on October 14th, Israelis from a nearby illegal settlement attacked his land, cut down and sabotaged the 300 trees he planted 20 years ago. Settlers also cut down six 1,500-year-old olive trees from the Roman period. "I cry for my trees," said Mashallah, standing on his land in the Palestinian village of Jaba, on the southern outskirts of Al-Khalil. "I feel that I lost the children that I've been raising for the past 20 years. He told Middle East Eye that only a couple of days prior to the Israeli settler attack, he visited his land and inspected his trees in preparation for olive picking with his family. "I was surprised when I got a call from one of the village residents telling me that my trees had been cut down," said Mashallah, explaining that he thought it was a joke. "I headed straight to my land only to find 25 donums, about 25,000 square meters of trees in my land cut down and destroyed." It was not the first time that Mashallah's land was targeted. In 2006, the Israeli regime army razed parts of his land and cut down 980 of his olive trees, claiming he did not own the land, despite the presence of documents in the family's possession that prove ownership. Israeli settler attacks take place throughout the year, but they consistently increase in number and intensity during the annual olive season in Palestine, usually from mid-September to mid-November. In the Palestinian village of Al-Mughayr, east of Ramallah, Israelis from the nearby settlement of Elad attacked the land of 60-year-old Said Abu Aliya. "Our land is attacked on an annual basis by settlers. They target the land by cutting down or burning trees," Abu Aliya told MEE. He and his father planted 600 trees in 1982. "Today, there are only 15 olive trees left," he said, explaining that each year they would lose a number of trees due to the settler attacks. 2 months ago, settlers cut down 120 of the family's olive trees.
Most recently, on October 26, he and his family visited their land, which they are only allowed access to twice a year and only through coordination with the Zionist regime army that dictates the days, time, and the period the families are allowed on their land. Abu Alia said that when they arrived, they saw that there were no trees left to pick. This land was a source of income for us. Today, it has become barren, he said. In March, added Abu Alia, when the family went to plow the land, they found that about 20 dunams had been raised by Israeli settlers